Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading the Midland Reporter-Telegram for Friday, May 8, 2020. Section A. Midland Medical Lodge. Lodge didn't completely isolate infected. By Caitlin Randall, CRANDLE at MRT.com. Residents of Midland Medical Lodge with COVID-19 were transferred to Midland Memorial Hospital because officials determined the facility was not completely isolating infected residents, Chief Medical Officer Dr. Larry Wilson said Thursday. Hospital officials announced earlier this week that residents of the nursing home who tested positive for the coronavirus or who were believed to have the virus would be transferred from the lodge's isolation unit to the hospital. Wilson expanded during a press briefing Thursday on the reason these residents were transferred. It was determined by the health department in working with the rapid response team that the facility was not completely isolating the infected patients or residents well. It's in their best interest to clear it out, clean it up, get the infection under better control, and move forward from there. Midland Memorial's CEO Russell Myers said the decision was driven by interactions with the state. The lodge previously released a statement saying they had voluntarily activated the Texas Health and Human Services Rapid Response Team. That team is providing training for lodge staff on infection control practices and using personal protective equipment, as well as doing a deep cleaning of the facility. When asked to comment on Wilson's remarks, a representative for Midland Medical Lodge said Wilson would be clarifying his statements. She did not specify what required clarification. The Reporter-Telegram asked Wilson if he would like to revise his comments. He said he wanted to clarify that Midland Medical Lodge made the decision to transfer their residents, but said he did not recall saying anything inaccurate during the press briefing. Kerry Powell, an administrator with Midland Medical Lodge, said in a statement that they activated the response team for staffing assistance to best care for our patients, and we transferred our infected residents to the hospital for further care. The nursing facility has been the source of the most significant outbreak in Midland County, with 58 known positives as of Monday, including 23 staff members and 35 residents. The City of Midland Health Department confirmed the 8th death of a resident at the facility on Thursday, as well as an additional resident and an additional employee who have tested positive. There are 27 residents from Midland Medical Lodge who are inpatients at the hospital, according to Myers. He said there are 28 total patients in MMH's COVID unit, with 3 patients in their critical care unit. As the COVID-19 unit has a capacity of 30 beds, the influx of lodge residents has put that unit nearly at capacity, and the hospital already has created a plan for responding to a significant increase in coronavirus patients. There are multiple steps that can be taken to assign more beds, as patients need them if the outbreak continues to grow. He said they are not anticipating more residents will be transferred from the lodge, but it is a fluid situation that can change from minute to minute. Take a Sunday Drive During Isolation by J.C. Lewis, JACY.LEWIS at HearstMP.com. My family has abated boredom with Sunday drives ever since I can remember. Growing up in a town of 4,000 people without a movie theater and any big cities basically 2 hours away meant a lot of time spent driving country back roads with my friends or cruising Harlan Street on Saturday nights. I'm not as familiar with back roads here that would probably end up on a pump jack site, but driving south from Midland showcases some beautiful scenery. When I first moved to Midland 2 years ago, I would drive around during thunderstorms. during this time of isolation, my saving grace has been to get in my car and just drive while listening to music or podcasts. The Moth podcast lets people tell their stories and might be one of my favorites to listen to escape. Radio Lab is a science-based podcast that helps me expand my random knowledge. My favorite podcast episode ever is Radio Lab's Colors, which can be found here at https://bit.ly/2lbypas. Spring also is a great time to see West Texas with a green landscape. Hisachi daisies line shoulders of roads, and ocotillo plants are blooming. For my latest excursion, I drove from Midland to Rankin. Rankin might not be the most beautiful town, but it has become a hub of murals thanks to a Texas artist. Matt Tumlinson started painting murals in Rankin in 2015. According to an article in Texas Highways, it is Tumlinson's mission to make Rankin one of the most painted towns in America. He has completed murals of Willie Nelson, John Wayne, and Matthew McConaughey. The murals are scattered throughout town, and finding them can be made into a scavenger hunt of sorts. There is also an interesting museum that's located across the train tracks. Unfortunately, it is closed during this time, but there is a historical marker that explains the building's history. Driving south toward Iran, the landscape starts to change. Small mesas start to pop up on the horizon. These mesas are one of my favorite features of West Texas. The option to travel east to the little town of Ozona might add to the experience, but I enjoy the wide open spaces. The Odessa Spire, which was unveiled at the beginning of December, is a sight to behold for many mid-century modern art fanatics. It is especially magical at night while lit up. State Highway 191 construction has also developed with the addition of a new Grub Burger location and the progress of Walk-On's Sports Bistro and Bar. The Alan Noel Art Museum has reopened its doors as well. The exhibit, Way Out West by Alice Lease, is still on view. The Stonehenge replica at University of Texas Permian Basin and the Comanche Trail South Park are nice places to get out of the car while social distancing. While the Balmoray State Park might be closed and Chinati Foundation doors are closed, the drive is still breathtaking. Plus, it might be the perfect time to witness the elusive Marfa Lights. Marfa is currently closed for the most part, but it can still be a nice town to drive through while practicing social distancing. The iconic pink courthouse is a must-see. Fort Davis has the McDonald Observatory, which recently turned 81 years old. Visitors might not be allowed into the building, but it is still a must-see. Another scenic route through Marfa will bring you to the Prada Marfa, which is surprisingly outside of Valentine, not Marfa, like stated in the name. And the art installation, Tiny Target, is located between Alpine and Marathon. Sol Ross University is snuggled up in the hills surrounding Alpine. Another art installation, The Desk, sits atop Hancock Hill in Alpine. Looking for more trees, the Lincoln National Forest might be just the right Sunday drive. New Mexico will reopen later this week. This would be the road trip to pack hiking boots to get out on the trail before it gets too warm. There are plenty of trails and camping should be reopened soon. The rock formations that can be found in some of the more desert areas are astonishing. If driving is the main goal, scenic drive trails can be found at https://bit.ly/2wbrxev. Roundabout Highlights New Tradewinds Extension by Stuart Doreen, S-D-O-R-E-E-N at HurstNP.com. The Tradewinds Boulevard Extension could be open by the end of the month. Jose Ortiz, the city's engineering services director, said Thursday the final thing to be done is finalizing power for streetlights along the road. trade winds in the north is the north-south road that could open up the area south of the Scarborough Sports Complex to more development. The total project cost is an estimated $8.829 million, half of which was set to come from the Midland Development Corp., according to the previous Reporter Telegram article. A signature piece of the extension will be a roundabout, which the Texas Department of Transportation states is a one-way circular intersection where traffic flows counterclockwise around a center island. Currently, there is one at the Spaceport Business Park at Midland International Airport. The one at Tradewinds and Aneta Drive will replace a traditional intersection with traffic lights. TxDOT reports the modern roundabouts use yield signs rather than traffic lights to control vehicles entering the intersection. This intersection design only has 8 potential conflict points, opposed to a traditional 4-way signalized intersection, which has 32 potential conflict points. Ortiz said the roundabout on Tradewinds will be a benefit to traffic flow and minimize the need for left turns, making the intersection safer. He said the upfront costs of putting in a roundabout are greater than the standard rate of $300,000 for signal work, but over time, there aren't the recurring costs that cities encounter with replacing signals. It has been reported that the city will also pursue a roundabout at the intersection of Garfield and Cuthbert. Ortiz said a roundabout also is planned for Thomason Drive, part of the road bond, where Thomason connects with Illinois Avenue and Beale Parkway in southwest Midland. Ortiz said the roundabout will aid in slowing down traffic from the higher speed corridor west of Loop 250 to what will be more of a collector road east of Loop 250. He said when the Thomason project is completed, Thomason will be one lane each way with a left-hand turning lane. We will be trying to find a way to discourage people from driving like the road is a 4-lane road with higher speeds, said Ortiz, who compared the future Thomason east of Loop 250 to a collector street like Neely Avenue, while west of Loop 250, Thomason will be an arterial like Wadley Avenue. City collects $5 million from March sales. By Stuart Doreen. S-D-O-R-E-E-N at HearstNP.com. May's sales tax collection for the city of Midland could have been worse. A sales tax collection is based on revenue from 2 months previous, so May's collection is based on March sales, and the year-over-year decline in sales tax collected was 9.46%. To put that number in context, March is when the coronavirus pandemic started in the Permian Basin, and the collection was going up against the best month of May in Midland's history, May 2019. Considering the circumstances, Midland still collected more than $5 million during the month, the second time that's happened in May in Midland's history, and the drop in May was less than the calendar year average decline, which was 12.25%. The numbers show that the $5.004 million collected in May was less than the $5.527 million in May 2019. During the fiscal year, which started in October, the City of Midland has collected $37.159 million, which is 6.95% behind the record-setting pace set last year of $39.933 million. With 4 months left in the fiscal year and more treacherous times ahead economically, it appears reaching last year's collection of $60.3 million is unlikely. City leaders estimated a collection of $55 million this fiscal year, which could still be a challenge. To achieve that, the city would need to collect $17.84 million over the last 4 months. The city has reached $17.841 million over the 4 months in just fiscal years 2018 and 2019. Before then, the most over the final 4 months was $14.944 million in the year 2014. Should the city end with that amount this year, the third best finish to any year in history, it would still fall $3 million behind its forecast. In Odessa, the city collected $4.608 million in May. That was 10.47% lower year over year. City confirms 10th COVID-19-related death. Midland County's number of COVID-19 cases reaches 100, from staff reports. Midland County, Midland Memorial Hospital, and the City of Midland confirmed Thursday the county's 10th coronavirus-related death. The patient, a female in her 90s, was being treated at Midland Memorial Hospital. She died Thursday. She was a resident at Midland Medical Lodge. No other details will be released at the request of the patient's family. The woman is the 8th resident of the medical lodge to die from the virus, according to information from the city. Also on Thursday, the number of confirmed COVID-19 cases in Midland County reached 100. The Midland Health Department is conducting its investigation on these 6 new confirmed cases. The 95th confirmed case is a male in his 70s who was tested by Midland Health. He is a resident at Midland Medical Lodge and is currently an inpatient at Midland Memorial Hospital. The source of exposure is contact to known case. The 96th confirmed case is a female in her 50s who was tested by a private provider. She is currently self-isolating at home. The source of exposure is community acquired. The 97th confirmed case is a female in her 40s who was tested by a private provider. She is currently self-isolating at home. The source of exposure is contact to known case. The 98th confirmed case is a female in her 20s. She was tested by the state. She is an employee at Midland Medical Lodge, and her last day of work was Sunday. She is currently self-isolating at home. The source of exposure is contact to known case. The 99th confirmed case is a male in his 60s who was tested by Midland Health. He is currently an inpatient at Midland Health. The source of exposure is travel outside of the United States. The 100th confirmed case is a female adolescent, 10 to 19, who was tested by Midland Health. She is currently self-isolating at home. The source of exposure is contact to a known case.
Hello, this is April, reading the Midland Reporter Telegram for Friday, May 8, 2020. Library reopens. First hour for high-risk patrons. Midland County Public Library reopened on Wednesday while taking extra precautions for the safety of patrons and staff. In accordance with Governor Greg Abbott's guidelines, occupancy will be limited to 25% capacity. Both branches will open 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday. The first hour of each day, 10 to 11 a.m., is reserved for high-risk patrons, including those who are 65 and older, and children 5 and younger accompanied by an adult, according to a press release from the library. All types of materials are available for checkout, and patrons will have access to free Wi-Fi and public computers. To minimize contact, circulation desks will offer only self-checkout, and services such as printing, copying, faxing, and notaries will not be available. Meeting and study rooms are not open for reservations. High-touch areas will be cleaned every 2 hours, according to the release. Curbside service will be available at the downtown branch only. Virtual programs and digital resources remain available on the library's website and social media. Virtual fundraiser to benefit Boys and Girls Clubs. The Boys and Girls Clubs of the Permian Basin is launching a new online fundraiser to replace events canceled because of the coronavirus. The digital fundraising event will continue through May 15. Opportunities to make direct donations to the Boys and Girls Club, as well as bid on silent auction items such as a guitar signed by George Strait and Southwest Airlines tickets, will be available at https://1.bidpal.net/bgcpb. The new fundraiser received support from a variety of companies and individuals in the community, including Alpha and Omega, Sewell Family of Companies, Emmett Headley, John Burns, the Garriga Law Firm, Bobby Bland, Community National Bank, Roslyn Redfern Grover, Double Point Energy, Cooper Construction Company, Salisbury Industries, Frost Bank, AIM Bank, HEB, Synergy Entertainment, and Henry Resources. For additional information, visit https://1.bidpal.net/BGCPB. Stimulus checks can be cashed at HEB. HEB is offering free in-store check cashing of stimulus checks and will waive select fees for the HEB prepaid MasterCard, according to a press release from the grocery chain. All HEB business centers will provide free check cashing services for economic impact payment checks, and for customers who want to manage finances, HEB has waived activation and monthly fees for the HEB prepaid card. For more information, go to heb.com. Grocery store hours during coronavirus. Albertsons Market, 6 a.m. to 11 p.m., 1002 Andrews Highway. For shoppers 60+, 7 to 9 a.m. Monday and Thursday, 3317 North Midland Drive. For shoppers 60+, 7 to 9 a.m. Tuesday and Thursday, HEB, 7 a.m. to 10 p.m. Customers 60+, orders can be called in 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. at 833-397-0080. Groceries will be delivered by Favor Delivery. For more information, go to newsroom.heb.com. Market Street, 6 a.m. to midnight. For shoppers 60+, 7 to 9 a.m. Monday and Thursday. Walmart, 7 a.m. to 8:30 p.m., 7 to 8 a.m. curbside delivery pickup for first responders and customers 60+, with disabilities or at risk. Today in Texas history. In 1846, the first major battle of the Mexican-American War was fought at Palo Alto. U.S. forces led by General Zachary Taylor were able to beat back Mexican forces. Today in history. Today is Friday, May 8, the 129th day of 2020. There are 237 days left in the year. On this date, in 1958, Vice President Richard Nixon was shoved, stoned, booed, and spat upon by anti-American protesters in Lima, Peru. In 1984, the Soviet Union announced it would boycott the upcoming Summer Olympic Games in Los Angeles. Today's birthdays. Naturalist Sir David Attenborough is 94. Singer Tony Tennille is 80. Actor James Mitchum is 79.
The Opinion Page. Guest View from the Beaumont Enterprise. Officials should set good examples by following virus rules. As our state economy inches toward reopening, some elected officials will feel the process is moving too slow or too fast. That's understandable, and they should certainly express those thoughts to the officials making the decisions. But in the meantime, they should still respect the law and encourage other Texans to do the same. Regrettably, that's not always happening in Texas. This week, Republican state reps Steve Toth and Briscoe Kane got haircuts in Montgomery County because they felt that the restrictions against these services were unfair. State Attorney General Ken Paxton also criticized a Dallas County judge who jailed a beauty salon owner who kept her business open despite repeated efforts by law enforcement to get her to comply with state guidelines. This is not setting a good example for the millions of Texans who are struggling with these same requirements, whether they like them or not. Neither Texas nor any other state has been seen something like this pandemic, at least since the Spanish flu outbreak of 1918. In an unprecedented crisis like this, stay-at-home orders and business closings are vital to stopping the disease. In fact, nothing else can do that. Scientists don't have a vaccine for the coronavirus or even a reliable way to treat people who become seriously ill because of it. But if the virus can't get from one person to another because people aren't mingling, it will begin to recede. Even so, the restrictions by Governor Greg Abbott have been about as lenient as any state in the country, besides Georgia. On Tuesday, the same day the two state representatives got their defiant haircuts, with neither one wearing face masks, Abbott announced plans to reopen the state economy even further tomorrow, and then more so on May 18th. Beaumont residents know all about the controversy that erupted when Mayor Becky Ames was discovered visiting a nail salon that had been ostensibly closed because of the coronavirus. She acknowledged that she should have obeyed the same rules that other people are following and apologized. Nothing like that is coming from the officials involved in these incidents. Kane flatly said, "I wanted to take a stand and lead and be in front to encourage other customers to go out and go to businesses that are being deemed essential or non-essential and help them stay open." Paxton said, "I find it outrageous and out of touch that during this national pandemic, a judge in a county that actually released hardened criminals for fear of contracting COVID-19 would jail a mother for operating her hair salon in an attempt to put food on her family's table." His comments ignore the fact that the salon owner could have avoided that fate if she had simply shut her doors when asked. She was finally jailed for contempt of court for refusing to obey a judicial order to close her salon. Barbershops and beauty salons in Texas can reopen today at 25% capacity and by following other precautions. Going forward, all businesses need to obey these kind of rules to help everyone get past this crisis. If public officials can't lead in this process, at least they should get out of the way for those who can. On Sunday, May 3rd, angels came to whisk Joyce to heaven just about sunset. Funeral services will be held at 10 a.m. on Friday, May the 8th, in the Minton Memorial Chapel. The family will receive friends from 5 to 7 p.m. on Thursday, May 7th, the funeral at Minton Funeral Home and Chapel in Borger, Texas. Memorial services for Gracie Irene Shaw of Midland will be held at 2 p.m. on Saturday, May the 9th at Nally Pickle and Welsh Funeral Home. Private burial will be held at 2 p.m. on May the 11th at Spring Creek Cemetery in Weatherford, Texas. Gracie Irene Shaw, loving wife and mother of three children, peacefully passed to be with her Lord and Savior on Wednesday, May 6th, at the age of 94. Gracie was born on June 23, 1925, in O'Donnell, Texas. Family suggests memorials be sent to Home Hospice, 808 West Missouri Avenue, Midland, 79701. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Pickle and Welsh Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.mpwelsh.com. Pedro de Leon Barrientos, 57, of Midland, went to join his Heavenly Father on Wednesday, May 6th. He was born in Matamoros, Tamaulipas, Mexico, and raised in Midland. Viewing and prayer service was held at Heavenly Gate Funeral Home and Chapel. Arrangements are under the direction of Heavenly Gate Funeral Home and Chapel. Family messages and condolences may be emailed to pipkin@nts-online.net, or you can visit our website at heavenlygatefh.com. Porfiria Pila Guzman, 91, of Midland, received her angel wings on Tuesday, May the 5th. She was born on March 23, 1929, in Matamoros, Tamaulipas. She was raised and educated in Mexico and in Westlake, Texas. Funeral service is under the direction of Luella Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home and Chapel. Family messages and condolences may be emailed to pipkin@nts-online.net, or you can visit the website at luellagarciapipkinfh.com. Nelda Mae Saunders was born April 30, 1947, in Brownwood, Texas. Her family moved to Hyman, Texas, where she grew up, attended, and graduated from Forsan. She was a cashier at 7-Eleven in Big Spring, where she met her husband, Kenneth. They were married October 4, 1971, and then moved to Midland in 1973, where she passed away, surrounded by family and friends, on May the 3rd. There will be a small memorial service Saturday, May 9th at 4 p.m. at Cahoma Cemetery, and a family gathering following at 6801 East Midway Road in Cahoma. Arrangements are under the direction of Avalos Sanchez and Thomas Funeral Home. Ashleya Lynn Jennings, 32, of Midland, passed away on Friday, May 1st. Family will have a private viewing on Friday, May 8th, and a funeral service on Saturday, May 9th at 12 p.m. at Luella Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home Chapel. Darlene E. Dixon of Midland passed away May 4th, 2020, at the age of 76 in Midland. No services have been scheduled at this time. Arrangements are by the Heritage Cemetery Funeral Home and Crematory. Ima Jeannie Robinette of Midland passed away Monday, May 4th at Ashton Medical Lodge. Visitation will be Sunday, May 10th from 7 to 9 p.m. with a service on Monday, May the 11th at 10 a.m. at Ellis Funeral Home and with Nell Rogers officiating. Please visit ellisfunerals.com to leave online condolences. Virginia Carter, 89, of Midland, passed away on May 5th. A public viewing is scheduled for Sunday, May 10th, from 1 p.m. to 9 p.m. at Nally Pickle and Wells Funeral Home in Midland. A celebration of Virginia's life will be held on Monday, May the 11th at 2 p.m. at the chapel of the funeral home. The service will be live streamed from the link at www.npwelsh.com. Survivors include daughters Diane Upchurch and Debbie Helwig.
Hi, this is Linda. I'm reading the Odessa American for Friday, May 8th, 2020. Section A. City blows $33,000 paying Austin lawyers. Lawsuit alleges city hides public records, by Laura Dennis. Records show the city of Odessa has paid more than $33,000 to an Austin law firm to fight a lawsuit brought by the Odessa American challenging the city's illegal practice of concealing public information related to crime. A Freedom of Information request to the city for the records only shows what the city was billed February 4th to March 31st by the firm Cobb and Council of Austin. Notes on the bill include research potential methods for shifting responsibility to the Attorney General and also outline motion to transfer venue. This FOI request does not include what the firm billed the city for April. The firm, on behalf of the city in a filing, claimed the OA's complaint is with the Attorney General and not the city. The OA specifically alleges that the city violated the PIA by failing to promptly release public information and by unreasonably redacting public information after unreasonable delay. The Austin firm crafted this position for the city in the lawsuit despite the fact that the city, and not the AG, violated the PIA, according to the OA. In late April, the Texas Attorney General's office filed a motion to deny the city of Odessa's request that the AG defend the city's position. The filing in the 161st District Court of Judge John Smith asks the court to deny permissive joinder on the grounds that the OA is not accusing the AG's office of failing to release public records, as the OA alleges that the city has done, but is taking issue with the city's actions and repeated violations of the Texas Public Information Act by redacting information from crime reports that is public, and also by causing delays in the release of information. The city of Odessa also requested that the court transfer the entire case to Travis County, where the Attorney General's office is located. The case cannot be transferred unless the judge grants the joinder. Odessa City Councilwoman Peggy Dean Wednesday said she wished a compromise could have been reached during meetings in 2019 between officials and the Odessa American and CBS 7. City Attorney Natasha Brooks at that meeting defended the practice of heavily redacting affidavits and said it was how they handled the information in Midland where she had previously worked. She was trained in Midland, and that is the way they did it, and no problem with the newspaper there, Dean said. I don't think she believed it was illegal, and she was erring on the side of conservatism. I don't believe she was negligent, but was too conservative, and we have to try and correct it. Weeks after that meeting, the heavily redacted affidavits became less redacted, but what had been a typical 2-hour turnaround for affidavits was still taking anywhere from 48 hours to weeks. The council felt very strongly we had gone too far in one direction protecting information. It really, truly was wrong, and we stopped it, Dean said. But the lawsuit was already filed, and she said the city wanted to hire an outside attorney with expertise in this area of the law. She said it was never the intent to hide information from the public, and that the legal bills rolling in are high. John Bushin, a media law specialist and counsel for the OA, said the city of Odessa's attempt to move the trial and to get the AG's office involved on their behalf should fail. The upshot of the Attorney General's message in its filing is that the AG wants no part in the city's scheme to use the Attorney General's office as an excuse for refusing to release public records, Bushin said. He said the city's attempt to beg the Attorney General to be party to the lawsuit, essentially by suing the AG in a third-party action, is unprecedented in Texas public records enforcement cases. The Attorney General is saying, I don't want any part of that. The summary of the argument the AG makes is that the AG's office has sovereign immunity to deny the city's request to join them in fighting off the lawsuit because that doctrine prohibits the city from suing the Attorney General in this setting. The AG's office also argues in its motion that the city's attempt to bring the AG into the lawsuit does not satisfy the basic rules of Texas state court procedure. The OA originally filed the lawsuit in January to force the city to release public crime records in a timely manner and in accordance with state law. Prior to filing the lawsuit, for months the OA had battled the city to provide public documents to both the OA and the public that includes police reports and probable cause affidavits in a timely manner without redacting information that has always been considered public information under Texas law. The city abruptly changed the traditional practice of releasing public crime information following the Odessa mass shooting August 31, 2019, that resulted in the deaths of 7 people and the wounding of 25 others. Police reports from that shooting that were requested in the days following the incident were only released in late January. It was after the shootings that the city began to demand freedom of information requests for all probable cause affidavits and police reports, which the OA and its media partner CBS 7 argue violates the Texas Public Information Act, TPIA. Information that is always considered public does not require an FOI request, freedom of information. Certainly not information that is covered under the TPIA. The change by the city resulted in reports on basic crimes being delayed by days or weeks, and often with large portions of the reports blacked out. In the past, the Odessa American received requested police records from the municipal court and not the city attorney's office, and often had those records in a few hours, unredacted. The city attorney announced that no records would be released until they were vetted by lawyers for the city. In February, state and national newspaper associations, as well as the country's largest newspaper chain, signaled support of the OA's lawsuit. The Texas Press Association and America's Newspapers, which represents more than 1,000 daily and weekly digital and print newspapers, recently issued strong statements of support of the OA's most recent legal action against the city. Also, Gannett, owner of the Austin American Statesman, the El Paso Times, and six other daily Texas newspapers, offered their support, as did the Texas Press Association, TPA. Abbott Modifies Order by Michael Merlo. Governor Greg Abbott updated his executive order Thursday via a press release that eliminates confinement as a punishment. Abbott was quoted in the release saying, "Throwing Texans in jail who have had their businesses shut down through no fault of their own is nonsensical, and I will not allow it to happen." The order comes after multiple people have been jailed throughout the state for defying Abbott's COVID-19 related orders. One of those arrested is Gabrielle Ellison, owner of the West Odessa bar Big Daddy Zane's. Ellison was charged with violating the order Monday following a protest at her bar involving protesters armed with AR-15 type weapons. The arrest of Ellison gained national attention after Ector County Sheriff's deputies arrived on the scene in an armored personnel carrier. While accompanied with Texas troopers, law enforcement drew their guns on armed protesters and demanded they put their hands up. Protesters said the sheriff used extreme force in the situation, and Ector County Sheriff Mike Griffiths said that the protesters weren't attending the bar in protest, but were only trying to intimidate law enforcement. Many of the protesters were not from this area. Griffiths said that those with guns were arrested because they were unlawfully carrying weapons on a prohibited premises, while Ellison said that they were not on the bar property, but were on her private property behind the bar. However, photos taken by an Odessa American photographer clearly show some armed protesters in front of the bar's property and in the rear parking lot prior to law enforcement arriving. OA staff observed Ellison asking protesters to move to her private property behind the bar and parking lot. Griffiths has been drawing heat on social media and personal threats. He said Wednesday night he had to call the bomb unit to his house because someone called the sheriff's office saying they were going to blow up his personal pickup. He said that they did not find any evidence of a bomb, but that he can't dismiss anything at this point. He continues to get hate mail from people who he says are from other parts of the country. Those threats and the immaturity need to stop, he said. The group that attended the bar while armed was the same group of people who stood outside Shelley Luther's salon in Dallas so that she could open. Luther was arrested, fined $7,000, and 7 days in jail, but was later released. Texas Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick said that he would pay Luther's fine and also that he would take her place in house arrest so she could go back to work before her release. A press release sent out Wednesday by Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton detailed that the actions of Dallas County Judge Eric V. Moye, who sentenced Luther, were a clear example of abuse of his judicial authority, and Abbott said that the updated order, if correctly applied, should free Shelley Luther. Abbott also said that he wanted to ensure that other Texans who were arrested, like Laredo residents Ana Isabel Castro Garcia and Brenda Stephanie Mata, who were reportedly offering eyelash and nail services from their homes in violation of the local emergency management plan, should not be subject to confinement. When Griffiths was asked if the comments made by Abbott, Paxton, and Patrick threw local law enforcement and local elected officials under the bus, he said, "It absolutely does. If you're not going to have any backbone and back us up, then why put the order out," he said. "If they're not going to stand by what they're saying, then why don't they just get up on TV and say, well, this is what we suggest? Why put forth to law enforcement to enforce these orders if you're not going to have the backbone to stand up and back up what you've ordered?" Griffiths said that although he doesn't always agree with everything Abbott does, he said that Abbott is the duly elected governor, and if he puts forth an executive order, we're sworn to uphold that order and the law. So it's absolutely ridiculous. Griffiths said he thought a lot of the amendment to the order had to do with Luther's case. 7 days in jail seems a little extreme to me for what she was charged with, but the fact of the matter is the law enforcement out there was ordered by the governor's order to enforce the law, and they did. District 81 State Representative Brooks Landgraf said, "Anything that's going to have the impact of the law in Texas, things that have that legal impact definitely need to be cleared up for people, for businesses, for customers to understand. And there also needs to be enough clarity so that peace officers can enforce them." He said, "Clarity is the key in the act of legislature and in the authority of law. I think that needs to be a guiding principle," he said. Part of Monday's bar protest, per Ellison, was due to inconsistencies relating to the reopening of Ector County, where bars are prohibited to open while game rooms can open up at 25% capacity. It is important not to pick winners and losers when it comes to businesses. And so, just for the sake of clarity again, it is important for the laws to be clear enough to be understood and clear enough to be enforced. And obviously, that's a little more difficult to do in a time like this. It's certainly a unique set of circumstances, but clarity is important when it comes to the rule of law, Landgraf said. Relating to Monday's events, Sheriff Griffiths said, "We stand by what we did. We were enforcing the law of the governor, and that's going to apply to the bar owner who was arrested the other day. It will not apply to those other individuals," he said, referencing the armed protesters. Griffiths said Monday's events are still under investigation, and ECSO is in communication with the county and district attorney, and that the organizer's intent was not to protest the Second Amendment, and we have substantial proof of that, he said. "This lady at the bar created this whole issue by inviting these armed individuals out here from other parts of the state. We had a mass shooting here August 31st, and that's still vivid in our minds. And when we observe a thing like this with multiple armed individuals like this, with magazines loaded, that calls for alarm for us. We want to go home at night just like everybody else, and we're going to do everything we can to make sure we go home at night. All it takes is one slip up, and me or one of my officers ends up as a star on the back of a unit, a memorial star." He said that those armed protesters should just take care of their communities, and we'll take care of ours, he said. In other COVID-19 related news, Ector County Health Department reports 94 positive, 1,253 negative, 75 pending, 63 recovered, 1,422 total tested. Drive-through testing, 212 calls, 6 positive, 46 negative, 18 pending, 70 total tested. National Guard drive-through testing, 84 total tested, 62 negative, 1 positive, 21 pending. The health department is not permitting any semi-public pools to be open for the 2020 season, County Commissioner Eddie Shelton said, including all apartment complexes, hotels, and motel pools. Medical Center Hospital, 797 total tested, 55 positive, 3 in the hospital, none on ventilators, 722 negative results, 20 pending, 1 in the hospital under investigation. Odessa Regional Medical Center, 325 total tests, 15 positives, 305 negatives, 5 pending. ORMC Chief Medical Officer Dr. Rohith Saravanan said new clusters of positives are directly related to social gatherings. City buildings officially opened up to the public Wednesday with limited hours from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m., and they recommend people wear masks and practice social distance while attending city buildings. If people don't want to go to city buildings, they can go to tinyurl.com/y63g2pqn to pay bills online. MCH benefit. The Kendra Scott Store of Midland will be donating a portion of their sales to Medical Center Health System for COVID-19 relief through Sunday. 100% of all proceeds from the State of Texas Charm and 20% of all proceeds from Midland curbside and in-store appointment purchases will benefit MCHS. Customers can make their purchases at kendrascott.com, which will then give instructions on how to pick up items at curbside. The Kendra Scott location in Midland can be found at the Commons at North Park, off Loop 250. Live stream graduations. Graduation ceremonies for Ector County ISD's Class of 2020 will be virtual this year, but they will contain some of the same elements students would have experienced in a face-to-face event. Dates for the graduations are May 22nd and May 23rd, and they will be broadcast at the same time they would have actually been held, Superintendent Scott Murray said. Permian is May 22nd, and Odessa High School is May 23rd. The graduations would be live if not for coronavirus. The one for Odessa Collegiate Academy is at 10 a.m. May 22nd. OC Tech's at noon, May 22nd. George H.W. Bush New Tech Odessa at 2 p.m. May 22nd. And Permian High School at 8:30 p.m. May 22nd. Odessa High School's graduation will be 8:30 p.m. May 23rd. Woodley says August opening planned with precautions by Ruth Campbell. Like other universities nationwide, University of Texas Permian Basin is looking toward a fall reopening, but with precautions and modifications to everything from classes to sporting events. In a teleconference Wednesday, President Sandra Woodley said there are a lot of plans in the university is working on to minimize the risk of COVID-19, but also come up with a plan flexible enough to enable the students to come back to the university August 24th. We need to pay attention to the health information that we have on the ground. Some of those will obviously be a spreading out of students in the classroom so that we can honor the social distancing from the CDC guidelines, Woodley said. We'll also have different rules for the dorms and residence hall and dining halls, again, just to make sure that we can minimize the risk. We're also looking at other kinds of academic options. In addition to the on-campus work that we'll do with students in their classes, we'll continue to utilize innovative ways to have blended learning, more online, some hybrid programs as well, she added. Woodley said she thinks it's important to signal early to students that the university will be reopening in some manner, even if it's changed. She added that the presidents of the UT schools are united in the view that they will have a way to reopen that minimizes risk. We know that in a pandemic, it's impossible to totally avoid exposure to COVID. That's not possible, whether you go to your college class or whether you go to the drugstore or to the grocery store. So it's impossible to totally eliminate your risk as far as catching COVID. But I think it is important, and I think this is true across the nation, as you know, that particularly provide a safer environment for those who are in the high-risk categories, particularly faculty and students who have underlying health conditions. We want to have more options for them as well, Woodley said. Spreading out classes, using larger classrooms, and avoiding large gatherings on campus are a few ways Woodley said she hopes to balance the well-being of the Falcon family and still offer the campus life that is important for students. Dan Heimerman, provost and vice president for academic affairs, is heading a roughly 15-person task force with leaders from across the campus on matters like whether to give students single rooms, providing spaces for self-isolation, and quarantining. As for sports, Woodley said the NCAA and Lone Star Conference are working on that, because it's not up to any one university or conference as to what they might look like. The discussion so far has included limiting the number of athletic events in each sport, maybe moving fall sports into winter or even into the spring, limiting travel, and limiting the number of spectators who attend athletic events. She added that some of the sports are already live streamed. Football and basketball are included in a Lone Star Conference-wide option available for streaming the event, so those streaming opportunities certainly will continue, Woodley said. When the football team is playing at home, they are at Ratliff Stadium, which is pretty large, so they can adhere to CDC social distancing guidelines. We don't know where the NCAA and the Lone Star will land on their recommendation, but I can tell you that we will be guided by the federal, local, and state authorities, and more importantly, we'll be guided by the public health information and the experts as well to make sure that whatever we do, it fits squarely into the recommended guidelines for minimizing the risk, Woodley said. If needed, classes would start on time even if students aren't physically on campus, using the same online options in operation now. But I suspect we'll be able to welcome students on campus in the fall and then have a plan in place for any contingencies that might be needed, Woodley said. On COVID-19 testing, she said the university is working to maximize its ability to test and contact trace. As some of you may be aware, our own nursing program is highly trained in that area. Our students work with county health officials, and they are doing so now to do contact tracing and to work with some of those kinds of strategies that will be needed if people do begin to get sick on campus. We'll utilize our own health officials, also the hospitals and the county, that we already have available to our students, Woodley said. For food service, she said UTPB will make it more point of service and let students take meals back to their rooms, for example. Even before the university shut down, it had stopped serving food buffet style. We'll be working Chartwells, our dining provider, to take a look at how we can provide the food service safely. There are already protocols for that they're working through. We have national advice on that, as Chartwells is a national company, so the dining certainly will look different, Woodley said. She added that there are multiple locations on campus where food service can be provided as well. Those are the kinds of things that we don't have fully nailed down at this point, but those are the right questions that we're working through, she said.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.